So I know that everyone on Capitol Hill is acting fast because I think there is a motivation to prove that they're capable of moving important legislation. But I actually would behoove them to not move too fast because this is dynamite sticks everywhere. It's very complicated stuff.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Monday, March 25th, which means it's Media Monday. Today, I'm joined by John Kelly to talk about the momentum in Washington behind banning or forcing a sale of TikTok, a bipartisan push that gained new urgency late last week after the intelligence community briefed senators about the looming security threat of the app, which is ultimately owned by the Chinese. And we dig into Jeff Zucker's failed bid to buy The Telegraph in the UK, why it was blocked, and why this ultimately might be a good thing for the former CNN and NBC boss, who is now looking for a new media company to take charge of. We'll discuss all that and much, much more, including some details of Puck's big party in Washington last week on today's episode of The Powers That Be. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/powersthatbe, netsuite.com/powersthatbe. That's netsuite.com/powersthatbe. Happy Monday, everybody. Welcome to The Powers That Be. I'm sorry about your brackets. I know everyone's brackets are screwed. You don't need to be the guy that shows up in the office holding a cup of coffee, though, and saying, huh, March Madness, huh? How's your bracket doing? Don't be that guy. Those guys are annoying. I'm joined today, because it's Media Monday, of course, by John Kelly. John, I want to get your quick thoughts before getting into TikTok. We're going to talk about Jeff Zucker's, I think, failed bid to buy The Telegraph in the UK. But I did want to get your quick headlines, because we didn't really get a lot of time together the other night in Washington at the French ambassador's residence, from Puck's party celebrating the First Amendment, toasting Andrea Mitchell, who gave some nice remarks. This is the second year we've done this party. It felt buzzier than the first one, my friend. I gotta say, as a longtime traveler through Washington media parties, what was your take?
Oh, we had a great night. It was our second annual, as you say correctly, it was our second annual First Amendment party. We started the party a year ago, both, I think, virtuously and also with a little tongue-in-cheek, recognizing that in Washington, this is a town where it's built on professional disagreement, and the one thing that everyone agrees on is that it's actually all based on journalism. I mean, when you think about like the sort of professional institutions in this institutional town, it's lawyers, lobbyists, people who work in the government, and they can't do a thing in the world if they don't have the attention and the relationships with the media, who not only sort of, you know, keep score, but also really keep everyone in line. And it's the one thing everyone can agree on is it is the lifeblood of the town. So Ambassador Beale was kind enough to let us do it at his place, the French ambassador's residence in Kalorama, you know, one of the prettiest parts of not just that town, but really of any northeastern city. I mean, you walk down those streets and you feel like you're, you know, shoulder to shoulder with Jefferson and Hamilton.
wow.
And it was, well, don't you think, I mean, all those buildings are so old and they're so beautiful. And
it feels like the most European part of DC to me. I used to live
right
in Kalorama. And like, if you go up Massachusetts Avenue, a few blocks over, it's all Embassy Row or whatever. It does feel like a capital city. It really does.
It does. It's beautiful. It's not like the rest of the sort of, you know, lime greenish tinted window buildings that were all built, you know, with the sort of post-Heritage Foundation money in D.C. Anyway, the party was great. Andrew Mitchell was lovely. Merrick Garland was there. He was fabulous. It's funny that, you know, as we were leaving the next morning, we all saw that he was suing Apple. He kept that to himself. Wolf Blitzer was one of the men of the hour. I mean, truly everyone from CNN and NBC News was there. I just occasionally would walk by Dylan and see how he was the sort of dragnet for everyone as they were flattering him and sort of then politely asking if their contracts were going to get renewed. a lot of our clients and partners were in town as well. Yeah, it was a blast. And it's funny, I also felt... It felt quite different than the previous year's party. Maybe it was second year can be easier. Everyone knows what to expect, and it was more fun. But I had a great night, and I was just really proud of the accomplishments of our team for putting that together. And you know, it was not lost on me the unbelievably kind things that Andrew Mitchell said about our business and what a significant deal it's become in that market.
There was some synergy there. I liked, actually, this was true in Andrea's remarks, but also in my conversations with a bunch of people who were there, and Tara Palmieri wrote up some of the names that were there, like Merrick Garland, you mentioned, Miguel Cardona. I talked to Mike Donnellan for a while,
all right.
Wolf Blitzer, Abby Phillip, Casey Hunt, Luke Russert. Luke was one of these people, though, that echoed what Andrea said, which is people sort of got what Puck is. I think she mentioned our willingness and our interest in making mischief.
Yes.
You know, sure. And winking at our audience. I don't know. That I sort of appreciated that people are starting to, if they haven't already, understand that's part of the goal here. That was really nice.
I'm going to share one story that may embarrass you, and maybe you'll tell Bob to cut this out. But I was talking to Luke Russert for a little bit, and his mother, Maureen Orth, who I used to work with when I was in short pants back in the day. Maureen, obviously the widow of Tim Russert, and a fabulous writer who was one of the stalwarts at Vanity Fair in the early 2000s. I mean, profiled Michael Jackson, Mia Farrow, et cetera. So I've known her for ages, and we were talking, and Luke said, "Oh man, you know, I used to hang out with Peter Hamby when we were both, you know, single young guys." Guys, you know, running around Adams Morgan, and Maureen said, "Luke, you were no Peter Hamby."
Wow.
Yes, it made me laugh. It was like Lloyd Benson talking to Dan Quayle, you know, who was like, no way. So
that's
anyway.
High praise coming from Maureen Orth, who is truly a legendary writer. But to Luke's great credit, Luke has written a book, a wonderful book, and I have not. So Luke... Peter right now is no Luke Russert, I should say. We did make a joke, though, because like, he's like a St. Albans kid, and like all of my family is in like Chevy Chase Bethesda, and they went to like Visitation and Gonzaga and all those schools. And someone came up to us and was like, didn't know that we've known each other for so long. And they were like, "Luke, do you know Peter?" And Luke like looks at the guy, I forget who it was, and he goes, "Oh yeah, we went to Hebrew school together." It's like two like
that's
Irish Catholic.
Funny.
Kids from, you know, well, I know he's claims Buffalo.
Isn't Gonzaga
but, you know, from,
where
like,
Caleb Williams went to school, the future number one overall pick in the NFL draft?
Caleb Williams is a D.C. boy. He went he did go to Gonzaga. He did wear the purple. That's very interesting, our likely number one pick. Wow, okay. I don't know how much time we have left in our A block here, John,
yeah,
but I
really
do want to talk to you about a story that is truly at the intersection of media, politics, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, which is the possibility that TikTok might be banned or there might be a forced divestiture. The bill in the House had a lot of momentum. It passed the House. There were some questions about whether this legislation would even be taken up in the Senate, let alone pass the Senate. Abby Livingston and I talked about this on a pod the other day. But members of the Senate had a classified briefing last week from the FBI, the Justice Department, the director of national intelligence, who basically like put the fear of God in these senators. And you had senators, obviously you got Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and people like that who want to ban TikTok and think China is a huge threat, Tom Cotton. But coming out of this meeting, you had people like Richard Blumenthal, who said the level of detail and specificity in this meeting was extremely impactful. Eric Schmidt, a Republican, said the ability of TikTok to spy is shocking. Blumenthal actually also said, quote, "TikTok is a gun pointed at Americans' heads." So not only do you have like Republicans and Democrats like Mark Warner, who have been talking about TikTok and the threat of TikTok to run influence campaigns and spread propaganda, also their ability to harvest data. Some Democrats have been talking about it for a while, but now you've got Republicans and Democrats both talking about it, and also with a new kind of urgency after this intelligence briefing. So, you know, I mean, you're not an inhabitant of Capitol Hill. I won't ask you if you think this legislation will actually pass, but I haven't really talked to you broadly about this latest kind of sudden push. I mean, obviously the CEO testified last year in front of a House committee, but this whole effort to regulate, ban, force a sale of TikTok is happening with, it feels like, light speed, you know, with what, 6 months to go before the election here.
Well, it's funny. Most of the attention has been lavished on the fact that Congress has mobilized around something. And on some level, you know, it seems like anti-Chinese government sentiment has, you know, has motivated this, along with the notion, particularly in the lower chamber, that Congress people wanted to prove they could do something. They beyond pass an emergency continuing resolution here. Again, yes, I'm not a denizen of Capitol Hill, but I harken back again and again to something that you wrote last week in Puck, which is that those of us who have slightly longer memories and lived through 2016 just recognize the complicated politics in all this, especially as we think about particular objections here. You know, Facebook was essentially tarred and feathered by all of liberal America as a conduit for Vladimir Putin to elect Donald Trump. And interestingly enough, you know, the rightly or wrongly, and it's complicated, it actually is complicated. And I think there was a lot of mudslinging towards Facebook that was sort of like MSNBC politics, you know. But the one thing that that your pal Donald Trump did get right was the, you know, China. That there is this, there's obviously, I don't think Blumenthal is wrong, that there is obviously a extraordinary data gathering operation that is capable of taking place in the CCP. You know, if Jack Ma can disappear for a couple months, I don't think that the Chinese government's having a hard time hacking into the ByteDance servers. But I say all that, but I also realize the thing that makes this country fabulous, as we say again in the show all the time, is we chose capitalism. To force a sale of a company is a really, really, really complicated thing, even if it's owned by a foreign entity. We're going to talk about a little bit of this in the Zucker segment too, because I don't know if it's brilliant or xenophobic. But as the world globalizes and capital comes from around the world, like, we are not going to be the only deep-pocketed investors. This is not going to be the last time that a Chinese national company puts an extraordinary amount of money to work in a product that takes off in the United States. Forcing the sale and figuring out how you structure that, how you move it, and the impact on the rest of the market. Like, Facebook is not, I just said, it's not a saint either. This will create it will create unbelievable artificial market transformation, and that's complicated. So I know that everyone on Capitol Hill is acting fast because I think there is a motivation to prove that they're capable of moving important legislation, but I actually would behoove them to not move too fast because this is dynamite sticks everywhere. It's very complicated stuff.
Yeah. You mentioned the piece I wrote the other day about this, and I was kind of writing about the odd political coalitions that have emerged opposing a TikTok ban. So you've got these young progressives in the House who are out there defending TikTok with the support of TikTok lobbyists, I should say. These young, squatty progressives are suddenly defending an app that has the potential to meddle in U.S. elections because it theoretically is a place where young people can gather, organize, and get information. Those defenses of TikTok are deeply flawed, considering it is a cesspool of disinformation and conspiracy theories, even though they've put some tools in place to fight that. The Kate Middleton conspiracy theory is being a good example recently. You went on TikTok. It was just like nothing but wild, wild stuff that was lightly regulated. And again, the National Security Council and the Director of National Intelligence say that through the ByteDance and TikTok, the Chinese government has the ability to influence elections in swing states. TikTok is of dubious value for political organizing. Some politicians are good at it. They're good at getting attention on TikTok, but it has yet to be proven as a place to organize. And they don't allow political advertising. So, you know, I don't know really why the squatty types are coming together in support of it, other than sort of vague notions of like youth politics. The more interesting salient thing, I think, to what you said, is on the right, you have these sort of libertarian types who oppose it, Republicans, because it would be an example of the U.S. government, potentially the executive branch, simply meddling in private enterprise, which is just foundational to this country. And yeah. So those Republican types are raising their hands being like, are we sure we want to do this? Because if the government can just like get rid of businesses it doesn't like, that sets a scary precedent. So it's that to me is like less discussed. But one thing I am like heartened by like here is that the narrative around TikTok, it's always been two threats. One is they're collecting your data. A lot of Americans and a lot of young people in particular don't care about that anymore. It's settled that like technology firms like harvest your data. The thing that people were kind of missing for a long time was the potential of this app to influence U.S. public opinion at a massive scale, in particular among people under the age of 30. And that, the gun to the head comment from Blumenthal, I suspect is what he was talking about. Like yes. People are dialed into this app, you know, half an hour a day, an hour a day. And it can change minds, and they can. There's all sorts of clips on TikTok that are out of context, and there's AI crap on TikTok. You know, stuff just like attacking Joe Biden for being old, senile zombie. I don't know why Democrats were so keen on defending the app for so long, but it seems like the momentum has shifted. John, I want to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this, but I do want to talk about Jeff Zucker's stunted effort to buy the Telegraph in the UK. Are you tired of sleeping hotter than hell? I sure am. I sleep hot. There's something crucial about sleep that eludes us when we're too warm, too uncomfortable, and too caught in the web of our own thoughts to drift off. And while curiosity fuels our days, science tells us that cool sleep recharges our nights. That's where Chili Pad by Sleep Me comes in. Meet the bed cooling system that elevates the quality of human life through cool sleep. The Chili Pad bed cooling system is your new bedtime solution. I love it. It lets you customize your sleeping environment to your optimal temperature, ensuring you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. Chili Pad works with your existing mattress. It's a water-based mattress topper that continuously controls your bed temperature from 55 to 115 degrees, allowing your body to rest and recover. This isn't just about escaping the heat, it's also about optimizing your sleep for better health, more energy, and improved physical and cognitive performance, which I obviously need hosting a podcast. Chili Pads are designed for one or two sleepers, so if your sleep partner likes to sleep at a different temperature, or you only need it for one side of the bed, that's okay too, and we know that's crucial. Plus, you can schedule automated temperature changes to trigger deep sleep. But when I'm at home, Chili Pad solves those problems. So trust me on this one. Visit sleep.me/powers to get your Chili Pad and save up to $315 with code POWERS. This offer is available exclusively for Powers That Be listeners and only for a limited time. Order it today with free shipping and try it out for 30 days. You can return it for free if you don't like it with their sleep trial. Visit www.sleep.me/powers because you're not just investing in better sleep, you're creating a better life.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back to the Powers That Be, everybody. I'm talking media with John Kelly, of course. John, on Thursday, I think Puck subscriber, I assume Puck subscriber, Michael Wolff. Mm-hmm. If Michael Wolff isn't subscribing to Puck, what are we as a business? He filed a piece in New York Magazine titled Jeff Zucker's Fleet Street Misadventure. The former CNN and NBC boss wants a new media empire. Is that even possible in 2024? He is referring, of course, to Jeff Zucker and Redbird IMI attempting to purchase the Telegraph in the UK, the storied kind of center-right
newspaper over there. Jeff's thinking, you know, at least according to reporting I've read from Dylan, is that he sees a bright digital future for the Telegraph, something that can be built into even a much larger entity than it already is. That effort was sort of roadblocked for a while in the UK as they reviewed whether foreign entities should be buying UK media properties. Redbird obviously has a lot of financing from the Emiratis. And now, just a few days ago, I think the British government, you correct me if I'm wrong, came down and said, no, you guys can't buy this. You can't buy the Telegraph. Their concerns were basically foreign ownership of a UK paper, which is basically sort of adjacent to what we're talking about with TikTok, actually. Yeah. I don't think Jeff Zucker has the idea of spreading disinformation campaigns in the parliamentary constituencies around the UK. But was the concern from the government in England, Rishi Sunak's government, and obviously the Tories, that Jeff Zucker himself would be in charge, or was it more concerns about the UAE?
Well, there is a little bit of that. They're blocking the deal, and the technicality it's getting blocked on, and this is completely similar to what we discussed in the first segment, is that Jeff is the CEO of Redbird IMI, which is an investment vehicle. It's basically a small boutique private equity company with like a billion in change in it, and the majority comes from IMI, which is an Emirati fund that's controlled by the Sheikh. That's where the technicality comes in, and then the minority, I think a third of it, comes from Redbird, Jerry Cardinale's larger private equity company, still probably a mega boutique. I mean, it's not, you know, Blackstone, but maybe one day we'll see. And so it was a risky deal all along. And the thing that Michael writes in his story, and yes, the Michael story is a little mean-spirited, Michael, don't you think, is that Jeff was a minister without a portfolio and that he wanted to buy these papers. And now it's been blocked. And actually, our Bill had a fabulous story last week about what Jeff might do now, because, you know, he's got to offload this. And actually, I learned something from this that I did not realize. The price for these entities has normally been pegged at around 1.2, which I think was the debt that the Barclay brothers, who owned this these entities, owed to Lloyd's. And to get the assets, Zucker overpaid. They ostensibly overpaid. They paid off the loans. $600 million came from the Sheikh. $600 million came from Redbird. The $600 million from the Sheikh, that's the Sheikh's problem. He's got to get that money back somehow from the Barclay boys, but who are, I think, in their 80s. But Zucker has a $600 million deal for these assets, so he'll probably have to sell it again. And I'm sure that bankers are circling. Bill reported that they haven't hired anyone, but they're going to sell it in a distressed market. Bill was sanguine about the whole thing. I think it's going to be tough to flip this. And I think there's also a bit of like the AT&T Time Warner thing, where so much time has been wasted on the regulatory approval that it's possible that they have to work hard to not lose money on this. And after all the bankers and lawyers fees and accountants fees and all that shit's done, I bet that they will lose money on all this. And I actually doubted the thesis and the logic all along that the Telegraph and Spectator would have an afterlife in the United States. I just don't see that. I think that the Daily Mail did it, good for Rothmere and DMGT, but I actually think in some way this frees Jeff Zucker up to do a bigger deal. And Michael did get one point right in the article, and it is dead right for anyone who knows Jeff Zucker in the stage of his career. He does not have, and I don't want to act like I know him better than I do, I don't, but I can tell you this, he does not have the personality of an investor, right? He's an operator, and he wants to run something. Investors, they are, it's like left-handed pitchers. I mean, it's a totally different framework and philosophy on the world and how you look at companies, right? It's framework-based. It's considered across the rooms you sit in and the industries that you overlook, and it's based on return profiles. Being an operator is being in the day-to-day of it and relishing it. And these media guys, of whom Zucker, you know, is the sort of card-carrying member, they're operators. And I have wondered, and I think, you know, Matt sort of flicked this from time to time, because Jeff Shell is also inside Redbird too. Like,
yep.
Let's see what happens with this Ellison deal. Matt had a great story on Thursday night about how Legendary is stepping up with Apollo to try and catalyze a sale of some of the Sherry Redstone's Paramount assets, which will at least potentially bid up the David Ellison Redbird group. And if they do that and they get stuck with some of the Paramount assets, I mean, it's all so complicated and so hypothetical at this point, but like, Does one of the Jeffs end up running this? Do they find a way to run all the cable networks that no one wants? Is that going to be what Jeff Zucker really does? I have a spidey sense, Peter, that if Jeff Zucker were given a large part of Paramount to run, that he would be thrilled to do it. And
I bet he
so
would.
So I don't think it's a bad deal that that this Spectator thing is going to fall apart. It's a deal scar for sure, but I think that actually, like, the environment's changed a lot between then and now, and Jeff's put money to work in other places, including a number of production companies that look very promising. I think that pulling the cord in this thing is the best thing that could happen.
I'm glad you mentioned the operator thing, because I think I was a little confused when Zucker and Redbirds first got together and started, like, sniffing out these deals. But Michael Wolff does write about how this works and why it makes sense. So basically, like, IMI would get 75% of a deal. Redbird would share 25% with Jeff. And basically, Jeff would run a media business. He would not be the entrepreneur. Redbird would manage the deals. Yep. And then Jeff would go in and, like, run X company or whatever. So that cleared up a lot. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, no, it's true, but there's a slight complexifier here too, because Redbird and IMI are both the limited partners, basically, in a fund that Jeff created. And I think Jeff has learned a lot, would be my hypothesis, in the year that he's been in finance. And again, I'm not trying to act like I know that, but that would be my hunch. And and that one of the things he learned, and I think this is the point that Michael made, was that he doesn't want to be the person who's investing Redbird and IMI's money. He wants to be the person running the thing that they're invested in. And that is a little bit different structurally than what they have here. And so he's the custodian of their money in these other production companies, right? He's on the board. He's managing the management teams. I think that there is still a desire within him to be the CEO of a media entity rather than the person who's reviewing the monthly financial decks and coming in for the quarterly board meetings.
I think that's exactly right. I want to finish by thanking you for saying finance with the proper diction. That would be the puck pronunciation, not finance. Finance. That was my, like, stupid, like, dad joke when Katie was getting her MBA with her MBA friends. I would be like, who here's getting their MBA in finance? Anyway, John, it was great to see you last week in DC, and I will see you soon for the White House Correspondents' Dinner Rodeo. Puck will be there back again in a few weeks. Have a good week, buddy.
See you in the Slack.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Ben Landy. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Bob Tabador, and Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.